coming up in this episode. Not really the ending that I would have written.
Is this the part that made you cry?
No.
The part what made me cry was what happened to Grace.
I wanted the reader to be able to feel what it's like to be adopted.
Okay, well, let's not make this War and Peace, all right?
I promise we will take only what we need to survive, as they say in Spaceballs.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge.
All right, Orlando, time for another book.
Time for another book.
What have you got?
Well, today I have an intergenerational novel about Black womanhood called One Blood by Deneen Milner. It's the fictional story of five generations of Black mothers, all in a line from the same family, mother, daughter, etc. The story begins in the early 20th century and ends today.
Wow, five generations. Sounds like a long book.
It is. I'm not going to lie. Probably the longest book I've read for this podcast, except perhaps for that biography of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This book clocked in as an audiobook for me as 18 hours. But I think I'm going to make the case for you to spend all 18 hours or 425 pages, as the case may be, with it.
All right. Well, what's your sell for the book?
Well, I got so invested in these characters. I mean, I cried. Deneen Milner made me cry. Oh. And I very rarely do that. You know, I'm not a Black woman. I don't have children. I know very little of that experience. And yet I felt the pain of these generations. I felt the joy of these generations. And I loved her writing style, too. And we'll get into talking about that later, of course. But first, we have to get through five generations as briefly as we can.
Okay, well, let's not make this War and Peace, all right?
I promise we will take only what we need to survive, as they say in Spaceballs.
All right, well, tell me about the first generation.
Well, the first mother here is Rubel. She's called Mama in the story. Don't know exactly what time frame we're talking about here, but it seems like it could be just after World War II. Definitely the Deep South, Virginia. Rubel is an old woman. She's a grandmother. She's a midwife, and she's eked out a living in this small Virginia town, helping the mothers of this small town, Black mothers and white mothers, deliver their babies. She's very superstitious. She practices root medicine, but she gets into trouble when she arrives at the end of a white man's finger.
That does not sound good. What's she accused of?
She doesn't do anything wrong. And this is going to be a theme in the book. She doesn't do anything wrong. Rubel delivers a baby to a white couple, but the baby, obviously, to anyone who can see it, had a Black father. So that meant that the mother cheated on her husband with a Black man.
Mm.
So Rubel has a choice in this situation. She can put on the birth certificate that the baby is Black and the baby will end up dead, or she can put on the birth certificate that the baby is white, a lie which would make the husband responsible for a Black baby. Rubel chooses the latter. It enrages the husband. A mob is summoned, and Rubel is led away by the mob. And we don't find out what happens to her until later chapters.
But that can't possibly be the end of the story.
That is not the end of the story. Her story lives on in the future generations of women that we'll meet, including her daughter, Bassie. And this is where I'll introduce the author, Deneen Milner.
Mama Rubel is, she is as close to an ancestor that you can get without her being gone from the earth, right? She is very connected to the earth, to nature, to healing, to wanting to be good for other people and wanting to really just sort of take advantage of what all that the earth and the ancestors and the universe has to offer. She is the closest thing that you'll get to a spiritual being. Bassie, on the other hand, you know, has no interest in any of that. She's very worldly and wants to take advantage of whatever worldly thing she can get her fingers on, and she will do just about anything to get it and to get away from what she thinks is a really simplistic, simple life.
So explain that some more. How does Bassie try to go from a simple life to a worldly one?
Bassie wants to marry into money. She pursues a man who's a preacher and a tobacco farm worker as her love interest. But this man treats her very poorly, beats her, rapes her, and ultimately, in a jealous rage at a juke joint, kills her.
Oh my God, that's quick. So there's nothing more to Bassie?
No, not much. Bassie is, in my opinion, the least developed of the five mothers. Her story goes by rather quickly and somewhat one-dimensionally, I'm afraid, because in this early part of the book, Milner really focuses on Bassie's child, Rubel's granddaughter, Grace. All hope is placed on Grace. Because Rubel and Bassie are now both gone, and I don't remember anything about a father, we want Grace to succeed. We start the book with her as a child, learning at Rubel's side. And then when she's orphaned in this series of tragedies, she's shipped off to New York to live with an aunt. And I think we spend about six chapters and two or three years of the story with Grace in New York as she gets her period, becomes a teenager. This is identified, I think, as the 60s.
Okay. And you say shipped off to New York. That doesn't sound like a great way to go, right?
No, shipped off. No, this is hard. This book is really hard, Peter. Grace's aunt is mean, evil woman. Grace is beaten savagely, again, for no reason. You know, Grace falls in love in New York, but the love is doomed. Grace gets pregnant. She tries to hide the baby, but can't forever. So Grace delivers this child, a girl, by herself in a bathroom. And within days, the aunt steals the baby, kicks Grace out onto the streets, and we learn later that baby, another generation in the story, is placed on the doorsteps of an orphanage.
Ugh.
And that's what happens to the person, Grace, that we've spent the entire first third of the book getting invested in.
So was that disappointing to you, what happened to her?
It wasn't disappointing. It was just sad, right? Mm. Because here we get an enormous chasm in the book. In fact, when I was reading it, it was as if we were starting another book. I even wrote in my notes, new story, new characters. It kind of gets confusing because that whole bit, Rubel, Bassie, and Grace just ends. It's a little confusing. But now we get the story of Lolo and Tommy. But Grace's story is over. We learn nothing more about Grace.
Her story ends there. For very specific reasons. I wanted the reader to be able to feel what it's like to be adopted and to be adopted away from your birth parent and that birth parent just disappear into the ether and you have no idea whatever happened to them, if they are still alive or dead, if they had a happy life or a sad life, or if they came looking for you or didn't care or why they left you. I wanted the reader to be able to feel what that's like.
Seems like Milner is really doing the classic author thing, right? Like just doing as much damage to her characters' lives as possible and seeing how the mess cleans up. But let me ask you, is Milner adopted?
Yes, she is. And when we get to the second part of the book, the story of Lolo and Tommy, it really feels personal.
Well, I could sort of tell by the way she was talking about it, and you could hear the passion in her voice, right? This is something that means something to her.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love this part of the book. It feels like Milner is drawing on characters that she knew, especially the scenes that she draws. And maybe that's a little bit of me, too, because I was born in 1975. This part of the book takes place in the 70s and 80s. It's set in the suburbs of New York, New Jersey, and Long Island, and I can relate to a suburban childhood of that era, mm-hmm. From Orlando, Florida, in my case. And I can relate to parents who were a little bit like Lolo and Tommy. Good parents, working parents, but complicated with some relationship troubles. I can relate to the parents' friends hanging around the house. And I can relate to grassy backyards, neighbors, and feeling a little culturally out of place. I really like this section.
This book is... it's a figment of my imagination, but it is very much rooted in all the things that I ever wanted to know about my own mother. Her name is Betty Dolores Milner. Dolores is the whole name of the character Lolo. And when I think about Lolo, I think about my own mother and just sort of her own journey from girlhood in South Carolina to adulthood in Long Island, New York, and what it took for her to overcome a whole lot of trauma to get to the point where she could be the kind of woman who could show up for her own daughter. There are a lot of things that I wish I could have asked her. I came from a generation of you are to be seen and not heard if you're a child. And so I never really got to talk to my mom about what it meant to be a Black woman growing up in South Carolina and riding the Great Migration up north, what it took to fall in love, what it took to find out that she couldn't have children and then to adopt, which is what I am. I'm adopted. And so the questions that I wish I could have asked Betty Dolores Milner are the questions that I asked of Lolo and Ray and Grace and Rubel and Bossy. And the answers that I got are what are on the page.
Okay, so she mentioned a name we haven't gotten to yet, Ray. Who's Ray? Is she the next generation in the story?
She is indeed. Ray is Lolo's adopted child because Lolo can't have children. And we could get into a lot of backstories here about Lolo's upbringing and why she can't have children. As it turns out, she's from a trauma-afflicted Great Migration family as well.
Okay, and so if Ray is an adopted child, was she the child that was stolen from Grace?
I think it's pretty obvious, and I don't think it's giving too much away.
No spoiler alert
to say
required.
So. Forgive me, Deneen, if it is, because that fact kind of unspools itself over the course of the second third of the book, with various clues here and there. But Ray, born in the late 60s, is therefore becoming an adult in the 1980s and 1990s when Ray is rising up a professional career in television in New York. And Ray, on the surface of it, is the woman who has the most agency and the most control, and she's supposed to have, you know, the best, most modern life of all these generations.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's a tentative agency that Ray has, because she still operates within the shackles that held her mom and her birth mother and her grandmother to some thing that made it so that they couldn't spread their wings and fly. And so she's, what's that saying where there are no shackles, but you still don't know that you're free, right? She's still operating from the mindset that your job is to be a good wife and a good mother and to take care of home. And yes, absolutely, you're supposed to have a good career and you're supposed to get a degree and you're supposed to be...
And catfish. And catfish on the table, too.
That's right. And have the catfish ready on the table, make sure the house is clean, but also, you know, be a superstar at work. And that is a lofty goal for anybody to attain, but especially for Black women, I think, in the 90s, when you had all of these different ideas of who we should be.
Is Milner trying to make a statement about the state of Black womanhood in America?
Absolutely, 100%. She told me herself. And the genius of this is that at this point in the book, believe it or not, we are nearing the end. Ray becomes now the reader's focus of wanting someone to succeed, like it was for Grace earlier in the book. We want one of these women to overcome, to get what she wants, to spread her wings and fly, to be unencumbered by everything in her way. We've now experienced at this point in the book all the trauma from the previous generations, a little bit of joy, but mostly bad endings for the Black mothers in the story by now. And so we want good for Ray.
Wow. So Ray gets a happy ending then?
I think so. It's a little complicated. I'm not going to get all the details. It's complicated and messy. Not really the ending that I would have written.
Is this the part that made you cry?
No. The part what made me cry was what happened to Grace, you know?
Oh, mm-hmm.
Just realizing that we have no idea where Grace is. But yeah, Ray, in the end, I think it's a happy ending for her. Not one I would have written, but it's Milner's book, One Blood. And the blood refers to the bonds that connect these women, even through the separation of adoption.
They're all connected by not just the idea that they're mother and daughter relationships, but they are Black women in America, sort of relegated to a very specific role as Black women in America that takes away their agency to be who they want to be, you know? And I really wanted you to understand the kinds of mothers that Grace and Rubelle and Bossy and Ray are, and Lolo are, and all of the circumstances that led to those specific moments, so that you understand that none of this happens in a vacuum. Life does not happen in a vacuum. Each one of us makes a decision every second of the day based on something that happened just a moment ago. And if we respect that those different decisions are made based off of those moments, we understand that sometimes we're not going to make the best decisions. We are just dealing with the cards that we were dealt.
And aren't we all just dealing with the cards that were dealt? I mean, could you imagine a story of you and your father and his father before that and going back generations?
You know, this is a story that I have imagined, and it seems like, you know, at first glance, it's a story of generations of toxic masculinity ending with me.
No, I can attest that is not true.
Well, what I mean is the toxic masculinity would end with me.
Okay.
Does not exist. But, you know, different generations have different understandings of what it means to be a man. But so it seems like the universal here, from what you're saying, is that she's transcended race and gender, at least in the emotional content, and managed to strike your heartstrings.
Indeed, very much so.
Yeah. So before we go, tell me, what gives this book the narrative edge?
That right there that I just mentioned, the transcending of everything to humanize these stories. But also, apart from being a great story, I mean, I like the fact that Milner uses plain, straightforward language. You know, with such a complicated story, I think too much poetry would bog it down. And you know that I love poetry, but this is the place for simple, strong sentences. Sentences like, "Nothing good ever came for Negroes who stood at the end of a white man's finger." Or, "No one sings lullabies for 16-year-old colored girls with babies in their bellies."
Oh.
I mean, I just love the writing here. It's a great story, well written, and worth the investment of time.
It's on my list now. The book is called One Blood by Deneen Milner. Orlando, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to Narrative Edge. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. This podcast is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Find us online at gpb.org/narrativeedge.
You can also catch us on the daily GPB news podcast, Georgia Today, for a concise update on the latest news in Georgia. For more on that and all of our podcasts, go to gpb.org/podcasts.